They were both shielding, but DeMarco was using only half his double shield, and Hollis's shield was still a bit undependable.
"Just what we both felt from the time we reached the valley," he replied just as quietly. "My skin's crawling faintly, and there's a sense of pressure. It's bearable right now, not really a distraction, but if the effect gets stronger or is cumulative..."
"You should probably use both shields," she told him.
"I'd rather not just yet."
She looked at him and managed a faint smile. "I'm fine. If it comes to that, you can extend your shield to cover me too. But in the meantime, one of us needs to use all the protection possible. This isn't sane, whatever's behind it. We need to make sure we have at least one sane and one protected mind on our side, just in case."
"It's the just in case that bothers me," he told her. "If we're right about at least part of what happened here, what's continuing to happen, it's also possible, maybe even probable, that neither one of us is immune, shields or not."
"Rhys, we need to know if the connection is still there even through both your shields. Just because it worked on the island doesn't mean it'll work here, especially with all this damned energy. Never mind the horror of all this." She resisted an impulse to rub her arms. She wasn't cold, but her skin was faintly tingling, crawling, just as DeMarco had described. It was a distinctly unpleasant sensation. He nodded reluctantly, and a moment later she was more relieved than she wanted to admit to hear a familiar mind voice.
"Okay, both shields. My skin isn't crawling anymore. I'm aware of that faint pressure, but just barely. Normal senses seem to be working, and I can still feel our connection. It feels strong to me. How about you?"
"Yes. Thank God. Your other senses really are okay?"
"Seem to be."
"Telepathy? I mean, outside our connection?"
"Some static, but I can read Archer clearly enough."
"Panic underneath the horror?"
"You're getting that through me?"
"Yeah."
"Better than I expected, then."
"Same here."
Archer stepped back to the doorway, keeping his gaze on them rather than looking into the room.
"The doctors have stopped trying to wake Leslie Gardner. They said it was probably best to wait and see anyway. They're baffled as hell, that's clear."
Without looking at him, Hollis said more than asked, "All her vitals are normal, I take it?"
"Yeah. By every measurement they know, she's asleep."
He waited, watching the two feds as they stood only a few feet away and studied the room. As far as he could tell, neither one of them had a queasy lump of horrified sick fear in the pits of their stomachs. It might have been easy to resent their control, their seeming indifference to the scene of slaughter, except that they exchanged glances just then, and he could, for a brief moment, see the sick emotions that training and experience hid beneath control. They felt it too. Agent Templeton looked at Archer steadily. "Normally, if I can use that word, we'd want to check out the entire house, look for signs of behavior to explain this, profile the scene."
"But not this time?"
"No. We don't believe doing that would help us to understand what happened here. Why it happened."
"Why not?"
he asked, mostly because he couldn't think of another question. "You had another violent death today, a suicide," she said, maybe answering his question. "Sam Bowers?"
"Yeah. Nice, ordinary family man blew his brains out with a shotgun this morning. Just sat down on a couch in the basement, dressed for work, put both barrels of his shotgun under his chin and... in the basement, with his wife and kids upstairs."
Archer drew a breath and let it out slowly.
"What's left of him is at the hospital morgue, waiting for Dr. Easton. The local doc I called to the scene said he wasn't up to the job. I didn't blame him. He'll assist her if needed, but the last time I saw him, he was throwing up everything he'd ever eaten in his life.
I can relate.
She nodded, then immediately added,
Bowers didn't leave a note?
We thought he didn't. Looked for one in the basement, the rest of the house. None of us were too eager to touch the body, and there didn't seem to be any question as to who he was, so his body wasn't searched at the scene. But then, when he was lifted to go into the body bag, the doc heard something. Paper. It was in the inside pocket of his suit jacket. It's at the station now, bagged.
She nodded again. What did it say?
It didn't make sense.
Archer told the two feds.
It was crazy. The same sentence repeated over and over, all down the page, with the handwriting getting worse and worse. All it said was, just me, not them. Over and over again, just me, not them.
8. Wednesday, October 8. Galen had come into Prosperity separately from Hollis and DeMarco, and a bit earlier, in an ordinary light-colored sedan that didn't scream Fed or anything else to attract attention. As per orders, he drove around the town of Prosperity and surrounding neighborhoods, seeing what he could see in the daylight that was rapidly becoming twilight. His psychic ability, if it could be called that, and he had often doubted so aloud, was not one that required any sort of mental shield. But in his work for the SCU, he was most often cast in the role of watcher or guardian, and both suited his innately guarded, watchful nature, all of which had built or intensified a pretty impressive shield. He was, other psychics had told him, buttoned up tight. But that natural shielding had failed him during the SCU's extended investigation of a deadly charismatic cult leader more than a year before. And though not another soul blamed him for what went down, he still blamed himself for the terrible toll taken when everything hit the fan, the loss of innocence, and the blows dealt to the SCU. No matter what Bishop said to the contrary. Galen had taken time away from the SCU after that, time he badly needed to come to terms with what had happened, because the blows to him had been both unexpected and deeply personal. And time he had needed to also come to terms with his own once latent and now awakened abilities. Bishop hadn't said anything about that, about new abilities, and neither had Galen. All Bishop had said, mildly, was that Galen's natural shield had developed into one that was nearly seamless. Seamless or not, Galen's shield had not stopped the blast of sensations that had summoned other psychics to Prosperity, even though he had not been summoned himself. And yet he had been. Galen hadn't explained it to anyone, least of all himself. All he knew was that he needed to be here. That he had a part to play as well in whatever would happen here. And once in the valley, he had felt the energy. His skin wasn't crawling, but he was nevertheless aware of it. The longer he drove around, minding the speed limit and not otherwise calling attention to himself, the more aware of it he became. It was pressure. Something bearing down on him. And on Prosperity. It was not pleasant. At first glance, both citizens of Prosperity and obvious tourists looked and seemed perfectly normal. But Galen looked closer, and he observed signs that virtually everyone he saw was both a little tense and almost imperceptibly distracted. He noted a few arguments breaking out here and there, nothing violent but tense. Unusual sort of thing to see out in public in a small town like this one. Then again, he was also aware by the time he had completed a very thorough exploration inside the town limits of Prosperity and around the periphery, that details of the morning's inexplicable suicide had gotten out, that details of this same day's multiple homicide were also spreading rapidly, so it was no wonder people appeared tense. They were quite likely scared shitless.
Galen had not contacted Bace or the team of Hollis and DeMarco in order to learn about the multiple homicide. There was a single radio station in town, and even though the local news report had been interrupted frequently by bursts of static, Galen heard what he needed to over his car's radio. He'd already tried his cell, but as Hollis and DeMarco had suspected and warned Bace before coming into town, it proved to be useless. There should have been a strong signal, given the four very tall cell towers he'd seen well-placed in the valley. But on his cell, the bars indicating signal strength were literally dancing up and down, from absolutely no signal to a full-strength signal, the entire end-to-end dance lasting for about 3 seconds. Not nearly long enough to even attempt a call or text. He turned it off and tossed it over his shoulder to land on his go-bag in the back seat. Then, having explored as much as he could before darkness made that a fairly useless proposition, he turned his car toward the sheriff's department to meet up with Hollis and DeMarco, as previously agreed. His timing was perfect. He pulled into a parking slot beside the newly arrived hulking black SUV before its brake lights could go off. Getting out of his car, he spared a long moment to study the Fox County Sheriff's Department. He found it to be a newish, fair-sized, two-story building 2 streets back from Main, and occupying most of a block, if you included the sizable parking lot beside and behind the building. It looked more than adequate, especially since Prosperity was the only town of any size in the county. He joined Hollis and DeMarco on the sidewalk in front of their vehicles.
"Local radio reported the multiple homicide," he said.
Neither of them appeared surprised that he hadn't bothered with a hello. Hollis said, "Yeah, we heard the report on the way over here, even if the SUV's radio was crackling with static. How's your shield?" she added, not bothering to lower her voice because there was no one within earshot.
"Pressure," he replied.
"Nothing else?" Galen shook his head in a slight movement. Hollis eyed him for a moment, then looked at her partner and said dryly, "It's a good thing you've started to be more talkative. Otherwise, I'd mostly be talking to myself."
"I thought you did that anyway," Galen said.
Refusing to take the bait except with a brief narrowing of her eyes, Hollis merely said, "The medical examiner is someone we've worked with before, Jill Easton. She's clairvoyant, one of those Bishop wanted but didn't get, except occasionally as part of the state network of docs trained to serve as MEs. She's still at the scene of the multiple. We only had a minute to warn her to shore up her shields, but she seemed calm enough before the warning, so maybe she won't be adversely affected. Hopefully, anyway." Galen nodded. "We're supposed to meet up with Sheriff Archer and his chief deputy inside. Unless the plan's changed or something happens along the way to change it, Bishop's sending Victoria and Logan in tonight and the rest tomorrow."
"I know Victoria's supposed to have a strong shield," Galen said. "But Logan?"
"We think it's a good idea to find out how a medium reacts to the energy in this valley." It was Galen's turn to eye Hollis. He had a couple of questions, but asked only one.
"You don't already know?"
"Afraid not. My primary ability, but not my only one, so I can't really be sure. I'm trying to keep my shield up, but my skin's crawling a bit. My guess is that what I'm feeling isn't spiritual energy, but Logan's the only one who may be able to tell us that for certain. Because that's definitely his whole focus. And it's something we need to rule out or rule in, to help define this energy."
"Have you seen any spirits?"
"No." She frowned suddenly. "Though to be honest, I haven't been looking for them. Maybe my shield is stronger than we thought. Or maybe this energy is interfering."
DeMarco said, "Probably both. You said the spirit who told you we had to come here was different somehow."
"Yeah, sort of wavery, sort of like heat off pavement. But since she was crying, I was too busy trying not to cry to figure out what else might be going on.
Galen said, "The downside of multiple abilities."
"One of them," she agreed ruefully. "And the empath thing is newest and was triggered in a different way, so it's giving me more trouble. This whole valley is filled with freaked out people, and not just spooked, but scared and tense and irritable as hell. A state of affairs I expect to get worse before it gets better."
She drew a breath and added calmly, "So if I start snapping at you guys, don't take it personally."
Galen glanced at DeMarco and noted that Hollis's partner was a bit tense himself, something he rarely showed.
"Both shields?" he asked. "Yeah. And holding. A sense of pressure. Apparently what you're sensing, but it's not bad." "Then she's the one you're tense about?"
"She is standing right here," Hollis snapped. Then she closed her eyes briefly, lifting both hands unconsciously palm out in a hold-it gesture. Then she shoved her hands into the pockets of her jacket, settled her shoulders, and stared at Galen. "Sorry. Since we don't know just how this energy is going to affect us, especially over time, we thought at least one of us should be as protected as possible. That means Rhys keeps both shields up. But he's still aware of how I'm feeling. Which, yes, is very tense."
"Got it,"
Galen murmured. "So right now, you and Rhys are as protected as any of us are likely to be from this energy. And from whatever it's doing to people. We hope. We also hope Victoria's shield will be solid here and will protect her."
"And Logan?"
It was DeMarco who said, "Risky as hell, but we need to know if this is spiritual energy. If it is, he should know quickly enough. And even though he hasn't been able to shut out spiritual energy, Bishop believes he does have a kind of shield."
"A kind of shield?"
"His words, not mine."
"And," Hollis said, "Logan was summoned. They all were."
"By some force we know nothing about,"
Galen reminded them.
"I don't like it when I get invited to a party by somebody I don't know. It stinks. I still say it could be a trap."
"Of course it could," Hollis said. "But considering that only 8 psychics were summoned, it seems like an odd way to go about setting a trap for only a handful of us. There are a hell of a lot more than 8 just here in our country. Quite a few, arguably, quite powerful. And why invite us here, at all?"
"That's true of this whole damn thing. Why are we here?"
"What we're here to try and find out," she reminded him. She began to turn toward the walkway to the front doors of the sheriff's department and stopped as though she'd run into a wall, her slender body racked with a sudden, visible shudder. Even in the deepening twilight, it was obvious she went pale.
"Hollis?"
She looked at her partner, for a moment, almost blindly, then said in a very steady voice, "We need to hurry." Neither of the two men asked questions. Archer met them just inside the sheriff's department, in the lobby, which was fairly spacious and contained a couple of benches for anybody who needed to wait and a high desk, behind which sat a very alert deputy. Glass doors opened on either side of the lobby, both, as typical of most law enforcement buildings given the current troubled times, guarded by coded locks, the number pad beside each mute evidence of security measures. Hollis introduced Galen, aware by the fact that the sheriff looked no worse than he had at the Gardner home that news of another event had not reached the station. But she knew it was coming, and soon. She had felt it, 2 sharp bursts of pain tangled with shock and confusion, and then nothing. Whatever she had felt wasn't close, she thought. At a guess, whatever had happened had been on the outskirts of prosperity. At another guess, they were beyond help. She knew Reese was aware of what she had felt, but they had decided on the way from the multiple homicide scene that the mind talk that was so much a part of their connection now should be used only when they were alone or needed to communicate something privately. Otherwise, things were apt to get confusing. It was confusing enough for the two of them. Though thoughts were clear and easy, Hollis's uncertain control over her newest ability meant that DeMarco was sometimes slammed by an emotion that wasn't his or hers, which tended to disconcert even DeMarco. Archer indicated the door on their right, saying briefly,
"That leads to stairs and the second floor, administrative, the main communications center, and other technical areas my deputies don't need to access regularly are all up there. This other door is the one we'll use most often. Bullpen, offices, conference room, break room, locker rooms, restrooms, plus interview rooms, and a dozen cells in the back."
"We don't have to swipe a card, do we?" Hollis asked a bit distractedly as she looked at the number pad.
"No, and it's a simple code. 91101. Easy to remember. To be honest, I've always thought the security for this building was tighter than necessary, at least here in Prosperity. But we followed the recommended security setup for law enforcement buildings in this state."
Then he frowned.
"A card would have been a problem?"
She smiled quickly. "I'm one of those people who affects things like magnetic cards, especially those for hotels and other door locks. I've been known to screw up ATMs, too."
"Katie's the same," he said, nodding, then added, "Chief Deputy Katie Cole. She's getting things set up in the conference room. If y'all come this way?"
They followed him through the bullpen that was mostly deserted except for three deputies, two of them talking on landline phones while taking notes, and the third frowning in obvious frustration at his computer console. It was a sizable bullpen, holding more than a dozen desks, and they could see the adjoining conference room, since the wall between the two spaces was glass from about halfway from the floor to nearly the ceiling. When they went into the conference room, they found a scene that was familiar to Hollis and DeMarco, and less so to Galen, since he tended to spend more time out in the field, often literally outside during a case. There was an oval conference table that could seat about a dozen people in relative comfort, with a power strip down the middle and a conference phone sitting in the center. Whiteboards had been set up along the wall opposite the glass partition to the bullpen, blank, but with markers and erasers ready. Archer introduced his chief deputy, Katie Cole, and if her smile was welcoming and easygoing when she greeted the feds, there was definite strain in her hazel eyes. Hollis knew immediately that she was psychic, but wasn't sure of the specific ability.
"We don't have much in the way of a start in here," she said to the feds a bit wryly. "The photos we took this morning at the Bowers house and the ones from the gardeners are being printed out now, if one of our techs can fix the printer. We have deputies out talking to people related to or friends with both families and with neighbors. We haven't called in anyone to give a statement yet. The notes taken by deputies are being printed out, or just copied with a bit more neatness and detail from their notes." She grimaced slightly. "Our printers and computers are being as temperamental as the cells and radios."
"Getting worse?" Hollis asked.
"Yeah, seems to be. It was just the cells and radios at first. Now it's electronics in general."
Katie started to reach for the nape of her neck, but quickly stopped herself. Hollis knew the feeling. She wanted to rub the nape of her own neck, which was not only tense but a bit crawly, worse than it had been earlier.
"I don't get that," Archer said, frowning. "We've never had any trouble before, and it's not like the equipment we're using is either too old and breaking down or too new and still full of bugs."
Hollis hesitated, still unsure of how the sheriff would react to what he needed to know. But there was a clock ticking in her head, and it was getting louder. Any minute now, they were going to be called to the scene of yet another baffling, violent event he would most certainly find inexplicable,
and she just didn't know. Making up her mind for better or worse, Hollis half sat on the conference table and looked squarely at Archer.
Sheriff, how much do you know about energy? Electrical, magnetic.
His frown deepened as he returned her gaze.
About as much as any layman, I guess. We use a hell of a lot of electrical energy every day to run our homes and offices, all our gadgets. Magnetic energy? Hell, I don't know. Are we talking about the cells and radios not working right? Equipment not working right?
Yes. And why it's getting worse. And why people are dying in your town. Her voice was calm and matter-of-fact.
It's connected?
He didn't look or sound disbelieving, just startled and baffled.
We believe it is. For some reason we don't yet understand. There's an abnormal amount of electrical and magnetic energy in this valley. Highly abnormal.
We don't know the source. Don't know if it's more than one source. We don't know if it's permanent or temporary. We don't know if it's a naturally occurring phenomenon or something being manufactured.
Deliberately? By a person?
It's been done before. You know about EMPs, electromagnetic pulses?
Yeah, they're supposed to knock out electronics.
Right, they do. Electrical energy can be overloaded, shorted out. The current can also be unstable. It can surge, become much, much stronger as well as much weaker, suddenly.
Okay, I get all that. I even get, sort of, that something like that could be interfering with cell service and our radios, the computers. Hell, sunspots do that. But the murders today?
Hollis kept her voice calm and matter-of-fact. The human brain is basically an organic electromagnetic computer. Our thoughts, our actions, our emotions, all are created, triggered, controlled by electrical impulses in our brains. Synapses firing off all the time, faster than thought. Different areas of the brain responsible for different things, lighting up when active and going dark when not. If a specific area of the brain is stimulated by an electrical current or influenced by a strong enough magnetic field, then the brain responds.
With suicide and murder?
There was now disbelief. Remember when I told you there was a lot of strange and crazy in the world? We've seen a fair amount of that. Enough to not discount something that's scientifically possible, even if wildly unlikely.
Like energy that drives somebody to kill?
Yeah, like that.
Elliot Weston set his gun down on the kitchen counter and looked at his two clients in a sort of vague curiosity. Former clients. Charles Simmons had a neat round hole in his casual shirt just above his heart and a very surprised look on his ugly face. One or more of the bones in his burly chest must have stopped the bullet, Elliot realized, because there was no sign of blood from an exit wound underneath his sprawled body. Lorna Simmons lay beside him, her mouth open, wide eyes blank, her clipboard flung aside. There was a neat round hole in the center of her blouse, and beneath her body a pool of scarlet blood was spreading slowly.
Smaller bones, Elliot supposed, or just a smaller body.
Elliot knew on some deep, quiet level of himself that he had done something horrible, something beyond horrible. But wherever that level was, it was unreachable right now. All he knew was that he was finished here, and he needed to make a few notes in his cell phone. He turned and went outside, sitting down on one of the white wicker chairs of the nicely staged front porch, and pulled his phone from his pocket. No bars at all, he noted, but he didn't need to make a call. He just needed to make a few notes on his schedule, that was all. Notes that this house was still available, that maybe they should look for less demanding clients next time. He made his notes and put his phone away, then just sat there staring peacefully into space.
He felt very calm.
Archer moved a little way around the conference table, pulled out a chair, and sat down. He could see all of them from his position, his gaze roving from one calm face to another. Even Katie's face, he noted, was calm, until a fleeting wince tightened her features, and she reached up absently to rub the nape of her neck. She'd been doing that a lot lately, he realized.
So, electricity made Sam Bowers kill himself. Electricity made Leslie Gardner slaughter her entire family, her kids. That's what you're telling me.
Archer knew he sounded incredulous. He felt incredulous. And it was sort of good to feel something other than sick horror.
Hollis moved to take a seat directly facing the sheriff, and the others pulled out chairs as well. She said,
No, that isn't what I'm telling you. It isn't that simple. Not exactly electricity. Energy.
There's a difference?
Electricity is only one form of energy.
There's nuclear energy, for instance. Atomic, solar, wind.
It can all be converted to what we call electrical energy and used by us that way. But there's also energy we don't actively use. There's an electromagnetic field around most living things, around this planet, the sun, around the electrical devices we use every day.
Seemingly without being aware of it, she reached up a hand to rub the nape of her neck, her unusual blue eyes remaining fixed on his face.
There are even some people who claim that if we can ever learn how to understand, really understand energy, we'll find that it really does make up most of our universe, even perhaps that part of us we choose to call our souls.
For just an instant, Archer was tempted to follow that interesting tangent. At least, he hoped it was a tangent. But then he shook off the temptation. Carefully, he said,
I've never heard of energy influencing people to kill.
We have, Hollis said simply.
She appeared to realize she was rubbing her neck and stopped, clasping her hands together on the table before her with a fleeting frown.
Some of that weird and crazy you mentioned?
She nodded. Up until now, what we've seen has been relatively minor. People manipulating energy to affect other people. Generally, one-on-one.
Archer blinked.
That's possible.
Very possible. There are scientists studying it all over the world, with various implications in mind. But actual cases we've had to deal with have been, as I said, relatively minor.
And what's here isn't minor.
Definitely not. We're talking about energy capable of affecting the thoughts and actions of human beings. People's minds are not that easily influenced, at least not directly, not like this. Not to do something so drastic and horrific as kill, especially kill family. But the energy that appears to be trapped in this valley is very unusual, as I said, and becoming stronger, more intense. It's likely to affect a great many people as it does that. With luck, most of the effects will be minor. Temper tantrums, fist fights, arguments. If we're not so lucky, more people are going to die.
Since Archer appeared stunned, DeMarco spoke up then to say,
We believe it's what's also disrupting radios and cell service. That's a common enough occurrence with any spike in electricity, any energy surge. As you said, even sunspots can affect communications. Affecting electrical equipment takes a stronger surge, a more intense energy field. The most sensitive and sophisticated would be affected first, like computer equipment.
First? Archer said uneasily.
We're afraid the intensifying energy could have an increasing and even cumulative effect on equipment. And on people, as Hollis said. This is nuts.
He shook his head.
Not weird or crazy, just nuts. Insane.
Quietly, Hollis said,
More insane than Sam Bowers blowing his brains out this morning for no apparent reason? More insane than Leslie Gardner slaughtering her family and then just going to sleep? Archer stared at her. There are more things in heaven and earth, she murmured. Then she added in a stronger voice, The Special Crimes Unit has encountered a lot of weird and crazy, as we've told you. That's one of the reasons the unit was formed. One of the reasons the FBI, not known for fanciful beliefs, far less insane ones, was convinced the unit was necessary. That reminder of something official and solid he could understand and hold on to seemed to steady Archer.
The FBI. Right. So how does law enforcement fight something like energy?
It depends on the source, but generally energy is fought with a different kind of energy, stronger or more focused, maybe more under control. In our case, it's fought by law enforcement officers and others who understand energy and who have been trained to use their abilities to deal with it.
Their abilities?
He felt himself going adrift again. Hollis glanced around the table, at her partner, at Galen, and lastly at Chief Deputy Katie Cole, who was studying her thumbnail very intently. Hollis smiled faintly, ruefully, then met Archer's suspicious gaze directly. We in the SCU have a lot of tools in our investigative toolbox, she told him calmly. We've all been well trained. So we have the usual law enforcement skill with weapons and observation and interrogation techniques, defensive driving, knowledge of law. Some of us are profilers. Most of us, really. We have some fairly esoteric skills for cops. Reese is a pilot. I'm an artist. We can both pick a lock with a certain amount of skill, and Galen can disarm most security systems in the dark. Archer looked at the other two very calm men, frowning, then back at Hollis.
Okay,
he said slowly. Her smile widened just a bit at his wariness. We're cops, bottom line, just like you. We were all trained by the FBI, standard bureau training as a solid base. And if we have more unusual tools for the toolbox than most agents, it's because our unit chief saw the potential years ago and decided there was talent being wasted. So he went out and found us. People with abilities that could help investigate crimes and catch criminals, of course, as well as abilities to deal with things most cops or federal agents were never trained to deal with. Archer zeroed in.
Unusual tools. Exactly what sort of unusual tools are you talking about? Specifically.
Hollis sent a pained glance toward her partner. I don't dance around a subject well, do I?
Not your strong suit, he agreed with a faint smile. Agent,
Archer began. Hollis, we're very informal, though if you forget names, agent is fine too. Her glance sort of lifted away from him suddenly and seemed to be fixed on something in the distance, the very blue eyes going even brighter, almost luminous, narrowing. We don't mind, she added absently.
Okay then, Hollis. What the hell are you talking about?
His voice might have been a bit sharper than he had intended. She blinked, looked at him, then smiled. Sorry. Things are about to get even crazier, so I couldn't really dance around it even if it were my strong suit, Sheriff. The Special Crimes Unit is made up mostly of psychics. We're all cops. We're all trained. We're all experienced. And we've been working with law enforcement agencies all over the country, particularly here in the Southeast, for quite a few years now. Archer opened his mouth. But Hollis went on before he could say a word. You talk to our unit chief, Special Agent Bishop. If you want to call him back, he can furnish you with a list of references as long as your arm. Other sheriffs and chiefs of police and detectives
City cops and county cops and state cops, quite a number of them within a few hundred or so miles of Prosperity, all of whom will be happy to furnish testimonials or just talk to you a while about their own experiences with strange and crazy. After a long moment, Archer said slowly,
I always heard my grandmother had the sight. Never knew her, though.
We found that sort of knowledge or awareness common in these mountains especially, Hollis said. They're old mountains, and people have been here a long time, long enough to accept that there are more things in heaven and earth than they teach us about in school. After another long moment, Archer said with commendable calm,
You didn't really change the subject with all this, did you? It's still about energy.
It's still about energy. She frowned briefly, then said, I hate parlor tricks, but any minute now one of your deputies is going to come rushing in here to tell you that two more people have been killed. Inexplicably. Horribly. Strangely.
How do you know that?
I felt it. Just a few minutes ago. Two people dead, and a killer you'll find inexplicable.
Archer opened his mouth, beginning to look angry, but was prevented from saying what he obviously wanted to when a deputy rushed in, face white, and burst out with words that tumbled over themselves in a hurry to get out.
Sheriff, we got another one. At least, it has to be. In that new development on the outskirts of town. A real estate agent shot and killed the couple he was showing a house to. A neighbor heard the shots and went to see, and the guy's just sitting on the front porch, smiling, like nothing happened. The couple's dead in the kitchen. The real estate guy's gun is on the kitchen counter. And he's just sitting on the front porch, smiling.
9. Wednesday, October 8. The neat little house in its neat little planned development was lighted from top to bottom, and this time Archer had ordered crime scene tape surrounding the whole house and yard. Neighbors in the mostly full development remained in their own yards, but some had migrated toward fences with other neighbors to talk, to exclaim, to wonder, and to stare toward the inexplicable. Inside the perimeter that only law enforcement and their acting medical examiner and her assistant had entered, a few uneasy deputies hovered here and there, staring at the lighted front porch where a murder suspect sat in a white wicker chair, hands cuffed but still smiling, a faintly inquiring expression on his pleasant face as he looked at the sheriff and two of the feds. Chief Deputy Katie Cole was inside the house with their acting medical examiner and her assistant. Archer had sat down in the neat wicker chair that was separated from the other one by a small table and which made up the attractively staged front porch. It seemed surreal to Archer. It was surreal. He looked at Hollis and DeMarco, both leaning back against the white-painted railing side by side. Only a couple of feet from the chairs, studying the murder suspect with calm, thoughtful eyes.
He sold me my house, Archer said to them, wondering vaguely if surreal was going to be his new normal. And I know you're happy with it, real estate agent Elliot Weston said with his pleasant smile. I'm very good at my job.
Archer drew a breath and tried again, as he'd already tried several times to get the answers he needed and quite desperately wanted.
Elliot, why did you kill them?
Kill who, Jack?
He looked puzzled.
The couple you were showing this house to. The couple lying dead on the kitchen floor, shot with what appears to be your own gun. Why did you kill them, Elliot?
Weston shook his head, clearly puzzled.
I don't know why you'd say something like that, Jack. I'd never kill anybody. You know I'd never kill anybody.
His voice was mild, his eyes guileless. Trying a different tack, Archer said,
Then what are you doing here, Elliot?
Well, this house is one of my accounts,
and I stopped by here on my way home just to make a few notes on my phone," Weston explained, pausing a moment because he lifted a hand to gesture, perhaps even to produce the cell that Archer had earlier removed, along with everything else in his pockets, from his person. It was only then that he seemed aware of the handcuffs.
"Why am I wearing handcuffs, Jack? Is this some kind of silly joke?" "Christ, I wish it were."
Archer looked at the agents.
"You two haven't said much."
Hollis frowned slightly as she looked at Weston. She kept her voice quiet as she said, "Well, he's feeling pretty much the way he looks and acts. Calm and a little puzzled. But his aura."
Archer blinked. "His aura?"
One of the tools in my toolbox. Everyone gives off an electromagnetic aura. Some of us can see that. Tends to show me someone's mood, even if I can't read them any other way. And whether they're holding in too much emotion, too much energy, or fighting off some kind of attack.
Attack?
Archer really wanted this day to be over. Energy, usually. The really odd thing is he doesn't have an aura.
Sure.
Her partner asked her, his voice quiet as well. Yeah. The energy doesn't seem to be interfering with that. I mean, I can see everybody else's, so if he had one, I should be able to see it. I don't. And I haven't a clue what that means. She looked at DeMarco. Are you getting anything?
Same as you. He's calm. He's puzzled. Not really thinking about anything. In fact, his mind is almost completely blank, at least as far as surface thoughts go. He forgets about the cuffs until something draws his attention to them. And he has no idea what the sheriff is talking about. Even more, he doesn't really care.
Archer looked at them a moment, then rose and gestured toward the nearest deputy.
"Matt, you and Kayla take Mr. Weston back to the station. Don't talk to him. Don't ask him any questions. Just put him in a cell and keep an eye on him." "A close eye," DeMarco murmured. "I wouldn't leave him alone, Sheriff. Not until we figure out what's going on here."
Archer nodded to his deputies.
"Somebody keep watch. Don't leave him alone at all."
"Copy that, Sheriff."
Somewhat gingerly, deputies Matt Spencer and Kayla Nelson each took an arm, helped Weston to his feet, and led him off toward their cruiser. He could be heard asking them if they could stop for coffee. Weston was smiling as if he didn't have a care in the world. When they were out of earshot, Archer stared at the feds, his gaze roaming from one to the other, finally settling on Hollis.
"Auras? I know people give off energy, plants, all living things, but you can see that? Colors around people's bodies? And you're seeing that around everybody else, but not around Weston?"
She nodded, utterly matter-of-fact. "And about what I'd expect. The colors all mean different things, different emotions. There are a lot of colors around everyone else I've seen today, and more now because everybody is tense, edgy, and feeling a lot." She frowned again and rubbed the back of her neck suddenly. "I'm sensing those too. Neighbors are scared, your deputies are horrified, and you don't know quite what you're feeling."
"Good guess."
Hollis offered him a faint, rueful smile. "Not a guess. We all have a primary ability. Most of us have at least one more, and some of us have more than one more. My primary ability is as a medium, and I can see auras. But I'm also an empath."
"You see dead people."
His voice was stony. "And talk to them."
"Empath. Empathy. You feel what other people feel?"
"Yeah. New ability for me, so not really under control. Sometimes it takes us a while to adjust." She rubbed the nape of her neck harder. Archer stared at her a moment, then looked at DeMarco.
"And you?" "Telepath. So you read minds?" "Not all minds. None of us can control our abilities 100%, and none of us can read every single individual we encounter. We've theorized, and science has pretty much backed us up on it, that each individual human mind has its own frequency, as unique as a fingerprint. Virtually all telepaths have a limited range. Think of it like a radio. I can pick up stations within a certain range of frequencies, but there are frequencies beyond my abilities to tune in. Can you... Yes, I can read you. DeMarco didn't offer more, just looked at his partner, a slight frown drawing his brows together. If the effects of the energy don't lessen at all, even after dark, then more than one of us is likely to be affected with or without shields.
She stopped rubbing her neck and straightened, frowning up at him. Well, I don't feel the energy lessening, but not intensifying either, not the way it was before dark. Thing is, I'm not sure I could tell at this point, at least not unless the difference was really strong.
Emotions getting in the way?
Oh, yeah. And that crawly feeling all over, especially on the back of my neck, is worse. Distracting. She drew a quick breath. On top of everything else, I don't think we're done even for the day. Something else is going to happen.
Archer, pushing aside the intense discomfort of even the possibility that his thoughts might well be an open book to one or both of the feds, spoke up then to say,
"You can predict the future, too?"
He was a little surprised at the mildness of his voice since he wanted to yell and break things.
"No, thank God," she said with definite feeling. I think it's still the empathy. There are so many emotions it's hard to sort through them, but I can feel somebody out there struggling, fighting against whatever he's being urged to do.
Urged?
Archer managed. She stared at him. Sam Bowers blew his brains out, leaving a note that said, "Just me, not them," as if arguing with someone who wanted him to kill the rest of his family, too. Leslie Gardner slaughtered her entire family and then went to sleep and remains asleep. I'd say she lost the argument, and it might just have broken her mind. For good. Elliot Weston shot and killed two clients and can't seem to remember a thing about it, or care at all. Please tell me you don't believe things like that are just happening, randomly, in a single day in your nice little town, without being driven by something external. Kim Lonigan studied her husband rather anxiously across the supper table. She hadn't been a cop's wife all that long, and in a normally peaceful little town like Prosperity, the job wasn't nearly as dangerous as it would have been somewhere else, so anything other than brief worry was somewhat alien to her. But this day had been unsettling and more than a little frightening. Talk had been flying round all day, carried by mail carriers and the checkout people at the grocery store and neighbors, and even if nobody was clear on details, it was definite that people had died today, died horribly. So Kim was worried and anxious, and not a little bit scared. Her husband's preoccupied air and expression weren't helping things.
Jim?
He looked at her, his normally clear gray eyes sort of odd, holding a kind of flat shine. For no reason she could have explained, a cold shiver rippled up Kim's spine.
What is it?
He asked politely.
You've hardly touched your supper.
It was the only thing she could think to say, the only thing that seemed normal. He looked down at the plate of spaghetti, the crisp garlic bread, the nice salad on the side. Then he looked back at his wife.
I'm sorry. You went to all this trouble, and it looks great. I'm just not that hungry right now, I'm sorry.
Kim had the scary feeling that he wasn't really apologizing for not tasting his supper, or for the trouble she'd gone to fixing it for him, as she did every single night.
Jim, you don't sound like yourself,
she said a bit unsteadily. He blinked, then smiled.
Do I sound like somebody else?
He asked in that odd, polite tone.
What?
Do I sound like somebody else?
The flat shine that seemed a veil over his gray eyes increased.
Do I sound like your lover?
Kim literally felt the color drain from her face. Not from guilt, because she'd done nothing to feel guilty about, but because infidelity was something she was abnormally sensitive to. She had watched her parents' marriage break up because of her father's chronic cheating, but not before they'd torn each other to emotional shreds and hurt their children dreadfully in all the turmoil. And Jim knew that. Finally, she managed to force words out, hearing them shaking.
Jim, I don't have a lover except for you. I love you. I would never betray you like that. I couldn't. You know I couldn't.
His head tilted slightly, and though his strangely veiled gaze was fixed on her, he seemed to be listening to something else.
How could I know that?
He asked almost absently.
I'm at work all day, sometimes all night. And you're here alone.
Jim.
Alone. And so tempting. Tight jeans and a blouse I can almost see right through.
Jim, sweetheart, listen to me.
She held her voice as steady as she possibly could.
I love you. I don't want anybody else. I swear to you, I don't want anybody else.
He didn't seem to hear her.
I have to work tonight. I have to leave you alone, for hours and hours. But you won't be alone, will you? Because I've seen them watching you, the men in the neighborhood. I've seen them. They want you.
Jim, I would never cheat on you. You have to believe that.
It was just a whisper, all she could force through a throat clogged with fear and misery. He rose slowly from the table, almost as if every muscle hurt, and his distant gaze saw right through her.
I have to go to work, he said. But I can't leave you here alone, can I, Kim? I can't trust you here alone.
She was on her feet as well, moving instinctively to put herself between the kitchen and his work gun belt and service weapon, lying on the living room coffee table. Even though there was a small gun safe on his nightstand for his service revolver, something required by his job, they didn't have to be so careful with his other guns when it was just the two of them in the house, he had explained to her. Not yet, not until they had kids.
Jim, you trust me, just like I trust you. It's so important to both of us, that trust. You know it is.
He moved around from his side of the small table, stopping less than an arm's length away from her.
I don't think I want to leave you here alone, he said. I don't think I can trust you, or them. The men all around, watching you with their lustful eyes.
It took all the courage Kim had not to back away from him, and her own fear of him hurt her.
No, Jim, none of them watch me. And I don't care about them. I love you. I love you so much.
She had come home from afternoon errands full of horrified gossip and speculation. He had come home from his own afternoon errands with something unusual, with more guns, saying only that they couldn't be too careful with all the craziness going on in Prosperity, that he planned to buy a big gun cabinet and keep it in the basement, safely locked. While she had gotten supper ready, he had spent nearly an hour in his den with the guns, saying he had to clean them. Kim had been only vaguely surprised then. Now she was terrified.
Jim?
He stared at her, his hands coming to rest lightly on her shoulders.
You love me?
You know I do. More than anything.
His hands slid upward until they closed gently around her throat, and he smiled almost sadly.
I wish I believed that, Kim. I really wish I did.
Archer drew a breath, trying to fight against the insanity of this
external.